Hello and welcome to Final Draft. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and Final Draft is books, writing, and literary culture. I love talking about reading, writing, everything in between. And look, I want to start off the show by acknowledging 2SER, we broadcast from Broadway in Sydney on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Now, I record from my house. I am up in the Blue Mountains area on the land of the Gundungurra and the Darug people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners. I want to acknowledge their ongoing connection to land and pay my respects. Such an important thing to do, especially because it is NAIDOC week, and this year the theme is always was, always will be. If you missed it, I spoke on breakfast this week about a new collection. It is called Ma Biddy, and it is a collection of new Black Australian writing. It's an absolutely fantastic text, and I'm hoping that I might be able to bring you some interviews from the terrific young authors between the ages of 18 and 21 that have emerged out of Western Australian University writing program with just some absolutely staggering prose and poetry that really helps explore and get to the heart of, I guess, a new generation of writers. Now, today on the show, I have a fantastic new novel. And I always love bringing you new Australian writing. Thank you everyone who has been a Final Draft listener for a long time, because for the last few weeks, we have been talking Radiothon, and I have been asking you to support us, and you have supported us in such a big way. And we haven't spoken about a new Australian book for a little while, and I am so excited because in the lead up to the end of the year, so many great Australian books. If you are wondering, you know, what to do over summer, if you are wondering what to give people, if you are in a gift-giving mood at the end of the year, oh my gosh, stay tuned. So many fantastic books. And today, I have Life After Truth. It is a new novel by Keridan Dovey. This book arrived with me 2 months ago, which it felt like a very different world, because Keridan's book explores a group of graduates going back to Harvard for their reunion, and it opens with the son of a fairly terrible president, perhaps the most terrible president, being found dead. This book explores what it's like to be an adult looking back on youthful opportunities. It's also just an absolutely ripper read. That really connects with our modern world. I'm so excited to explore it with you, and so excited to be exploring it with you in a world where some of the characters that it loosely depicts are perhaps on the decline. So Keridan Dovey's Life After Truth, I'm not going to say any more. I want Keridan to really speak for this book. So you are on Final Draft, and my interview with Keridan Dovey, it's coming up after this short break.
Tell him he's dreaming.
Beer's cold, and there's plenty of shrimps on the bar.
This Sunday from 8 till 11 on 2SER, we'll be taking a dive into the world of Australian marathon runners, live musicians in the Aussie pub scene, and some of the people working closely to help our native wildlife. All of that and more this Sunday from 8 till 11 a.m. in an Australiana special, a student broadcast by Macquarie University on 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft. It is books, writing, and literary culture. My name is Andrew Popel, and I'm really excited to be joined on the line by Keridan Dovey. Keridan is a writer of fiction, creative nonfiction, essays, and profiles. Her books include Blood Kin, Only the Animals, and In the Garden of Fugitives. Today, she is joining me to discuss her new novel, Life After Truth. Keridan, thank you so much. It's so great to have you here.
Oh, thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Now, Life After Truth, such a fascinating setup, such a great title. On the eve of their 15th reunion, five friends return to Harvard University and the scene of some of their fondest memories. They're now spread around the world, and the reunion offers an opportunity, perhaps a trap, propelling them back towards their younger conceptions of themselves. And look, I've got to admit, Keridan, how to characterize Life After Truth was enormously challenging for me, because this is not simply one kind of story as I found it, but I thought I want to start with a structural choice, perhaps around the plotting. Your prologue opens with the son of the American president, a Harvard alum returning for the reunion, dead. And I was all ready for a detective-style kind of crime story. I was ready to follow the clues to solve the murder, all the while wondering if the killer would be more hero than villain, because this is, let's say this is a familiar-looking hierarchy in the American system. And you do sort of give us this, but it's in the form of this in-depth exploration of the psyches of your ensemble of characters. You take us back to the beginning of the reunion, before the opening event happens. Were you conscious of mystery tropes as you were plotting, as you were setting this up? Did you want the reader looking at your characters in this way?
Wow, that is such a good question, Andrew. I think two answers to that. I knew that I was going to be doing a lot of reminiscing through the characters, and lots of sort of stream of consciousness remembering of the past, and then interwoven into the, you know, live in-person events of this reunion weekend. So it was a nice sort of ring-fenced way to set up these characters to interact, but then I knew that they were all going to, you know, internally be looking back at their own past and really trying to measure themselves against their own past. And so I think I just wanted to have a sense of that there was something else at stake in the book. And you're right, it's not a murder mystery. And anybody who picks it up hoping that it will probably be disappointed. Although at the end, you probably, you know, you may or may not figure out who actually killed this horrible son of an evil president. But it just gave me something a little bit more to play with, to propel some of the narratives. It's something I actually struggle with, is dialogue and in real time scene writing. Like, that's probably my least favorite part of writing fiction. And so I think I try and find ways to force myself to kind of keep bringing them back into that present moment, and to put them in conversation with each other, and not to just get stuck in a you know, looking backwards way of writing, which is probably where I feel most comfortable.
But in calling the novel Life After Truth, initially you capture something of the last 4 to 5 years. But then as it sits in the story, I started to focus on those first two words, this idea of life after. And returning to Harvard for the characters, it triggers, as you just pointed out, that almost mass introspection. As a group, they look back on their lives, they challenge what they find in their lives. And I wondered if that idea of life after truth, was conceiving of yourself in different life stages, this idea that, you know, you have a certain truth when you're in your teens, and then a different truth when you're in your 20s, and so on.
Yes, I think probably subconsciously that was where I was thinking. I think initially I was just very pleased with my own wordplay, because the Harvard motto in Latin from the 1600s is veritas, so truth. And so I was pleased that, you know, I had found a way to both look to put the looking glass over the notion of, you know, life after Harvard and where that goes. It generally goes downhill. And then the post-truth world that we've all been forced into, you know, thanks to Trump, but also thanks to big tech and all the other things that have contributed to us no longer sharing a reality that we can all agree on.
And perhaps in the thread of your narrative, we also have complicity in this. As much as each of your characters may feel that they haven't achieved something that they perhaps wanted to, they were at all times complicit in that. They made the choices that brought them to where they are.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's where it's powerful to be at midlife, because you have to be throwing off any of your old excuses and blame of others. And, you know, it's that long, hard, cold look at your own choices and decisions without palming it off on, you know, someone else. So they're complicit. You know, they happily took the privilege and the mantle that going to Harvard gave them, and then they, you know, made that work for them. And there's a scene where Jomo actively questions even his own positioning, where he you know, acknowledges that he's a gem dealer. He deals in precious gems and makes bespoke luxury jewelry for rich people. And he got into business school because in the end he had to swallow his pride and go and ask Fred Reese Sr. before he was president for a recommendation to get into business school. So, yeah, I made sure that every one of the characters had to have that moment of reckoning, you know, with themselves.
A big part, I've got so many ideas that I want to explore, but I want to focus in on the idea of parenthood, because that becomes such a focal point of the introspection. Those of the characters with kids, they sort of fiercely hold their decision in defense against those without. There's a particularly sort of charged scene around that. At one point, Rowan ponders that socializing a miniature wild human so they eventually become a useful member of society was the hardest work on earth. It was designed to be done in community, not by one person alone or even two people. And he's doing that in conversation with the book that Eloise has written. You show us various types of parents and parenting in Life After Truth. I wondered what you thought about this plurality of parenting types and how they sit in the world.
Those are my favourite parts to write. It's just after sort of 9 years of hardcore, you know, full contact parenting myself, I had a lot of material that I'd never used before because I've never really written a contemporary novel of manners, you know, where I could really just go into some of that and turn my eye on some of the, you know, modern follies of parenting. But the book that really helped me actually push that a bit deeper, and I acknowledge it at the end of the novel, is a nonfiction book called All Joy and No Fun that an American woman called Jennifer Senior wrote. And it just blew my mind when I read this book about 4 years ago, because it was a ethnography of modern parenting. And instead of doing the judging of, you know, there's so much judging between parents who are in the trenches and, you know, everybody's kind of struggling, doing their best, totally overwhelmed, sort of knows that it doesn't feel quite right to be doing it in the way that we, you know, do it in, you know, in a rich first world country, but can't put their finger on exactly why. And in this book, she, you know, took it back and put it into context, of anthropological context, and trace all sorts of other developments, and particularly the return of women to the workforce, and then the way that that meant that suddenly you couldn't do the kind of casual share care that women used to do when, you know, traditionally they were mostly at home and the men were off at work, because you knew there were eyes on the street, you know, were at home during a weekday. There were other women at home and the kids could sort of roam free. And then women go back into the workforce, which is obviously a positive thing, but the outcome of that in a way is that we've gone back to this insane, you know, nuclear unit is where it begins and ends. And parents who are more present than ever before physically, you know, because kids aren't given that space to roam or anything, but they're not present mentally because the technologies that we've developed have meant we're completely distracted all the time. And so that bizarre experience I think that many modern kids are having of having a physically present parent who's mentally absent most of the time, like what that generation is going to end up being is going to be interesting. But by putting it into context like that and looking at the ways in which the various emotions and textures of parenting and, you know, the ideas around this fearful joy that you feel when you watch your kids sleep, you know, you feel this love and then you're immediately overwhelmed with terror of loss. And again, you know, it's such a modern phenomenon to love your kids to distraction. It's a luxury. It's the ultimate luxury, actually, to have a small family size and then to pour everything you have into those kids. So I wanted to try and capture some of that contextual stuff around why does modern parenting feel the way that it does, you know, in certain societies around the world and obviously of a certain class level, but what have we done to ourselves, you know? Why are we doing it this way? And that sense also, I think, at one point, Mariam thinks about the fact that, you know, in the past, people knew what they were preparing their kids for. They were preparing them for to take their place in a traditional society where the roles were predetermined and very clear. And so as a parent, you knew, okay, that's my job, is to raise this kid to take their place on these, you know, in this society and to fulfill these traditions that are time honored. And now nobody knows what to prepare a kid for. And so that whole notion of stuffing your kid full of skills, which again, it's very easy to make fun of parents for doing that and to say that it's, you know, obsessive parenting, you know, so kids doing a gazillion extracurriculars and, you know, judo and oboe and Mandarin classes and coding and all of that. But I really tried to take it to the next level and not just have that be something that's satirized in the novel, but to try and understand that, you know, we're doing that because nobody knows what future you're trying to prepare your kid for. So you are trying to actually just stuff them full of skills for an unknown future. And that's a radically different way to parent than probably any parent has in the past. So I think as an anthropologist originally, I studied social anthropology in my earlier years. And I think it's that way where you're both a participant and an observer. You know, that's what field work is. You're basically lurking at the fringes of groups that you sort of belong to, but you're sort of outside of. And I feel a bit like I've been doing field work on modern parenting for 9 years. And so I wanted to capture some of those things, but I hope from a place of compassion, not cruelty. So that's why, you know, it's not a satire. I feel like satire comes from a slightly cruel place, but I wanted to show the inconsistencies within these individual people, like the way that Mariam, you know, has a rule for herself that she will never judge another woman's practices of mothering out loud. Mm. But internally, in her internal monologue, it's just a shit show of, you know, no holds barred judgment. So, you know, those sorts of things. But ultimately, I hope it's maybe even a little bit useful for people who are reading it and might be going through that same life stage to just be a bit more compassionate about this to themselves and to understand at a slightly deeper level, you know, why it is that we are parenting this way. It's not entirely actually in our control. There's much bigger forces historically, economically, sociologically that have led us to this point.
This is Final Draft, Books, Writing and Literary Culture. You're tuned into 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel and I am in conversation with Keridan Dovey. We are discussing Keridan's new novel, Life After Truth, set at a Harvard reunion where the awful, awful son of the president has been found dead. And the book is exploring themes of parenting and power and regret. I was really interested in the way you stretch those ideas of parenting too, and also that power relationship between parent and child. And there's a scene that I actually just really loved, and I loved it for the way it flips a trope of parent-child sort of storytelling, and that is that sort of idea of the precocious child speaking wisdom that the adults can't see. And in Life After Truth, there is a story, a plot line where Eloise and her wife Binks. Binks is a post-humanist theorist and scientist, and has created Ellie Plus, which is an artificial intelligence form of Eloise. And there is a point where Eloise is in desperation, talking to Ellie Plus. And it is only through that reflective conversation that Eloise can get the wisdom that she can't access herself. And I thought, I mean, that is just such a beautifully bizarre flipping of that trope of the precociously wise child in that parent relationship.
Yeah, that's true, because the only human children in the book are never saying anything wise. They're usually just, you know, screaming from the toilet for their bums to be wiped.
Mm.
So maybe that's an indictment of humanity. But yeah, that was a fun relationship to write as well, between Eloise and her social robot, Ellie Plus. And it's actually not as weird and sci-fi as that might sound, but it's based on, there's a very smart tech titan woman called Martine Rothblatt. and her wife, Fina, she's actually, Martine's created a social robot of Fina. So you can actually go online and watch Fina's social robot being asked all sorts of questions, and she often has these really bizarrely wise answers. And so even though, you know, it's, you know, a program thing, it was built based on, you know, thousands of hours of interviews with the real-life Fina, trying to capture exactly how she would speak or think or answer anything. And it's quite a – you can actually look up a transcription of, I think, a journalist wanted to interview Fina, the social robot. So she's just got a head and shoulders. It's quite uncanny looking to see her speak. But her answers to the questions are – I mean, it's like profound, slightly absurdist poetry. And so I was trying to capture a little bit of that in that relationship between Eloise and her social robot.
And a really interesting there exploration of the dynamic of parenting, because part of that realization for Eloise is also that she has been holding so much back from Ellie Plus. You talked there about part of Ellie Plus's heuristics and artificial intelligence is hours and hours of interviews with Eloise, and Eloise confesses to Ellie Plus that she hasn't told her everything, which is, that's parenting. That's so much of, even as an adult with adult parents, we are constantly learning, because, you know, it's not an open book that you can just read the personality of the other person from.
Absolutely. And then there's the terrifying possibility and, you know, certainty that then one day your kids will write your own story for you, the story of you as parent, and you will have no control over that. You know, something I often think about, if I think back to some of my ancestors and the stories that have been passed on through the generations about them, and I often wonder, like, you know, how would they feel that of everything they were as a human being and all the life they lived, that it's this story that has, you know, stood the test of time. And it's often a kind of shitty story about someone as a parent, like a cruelty or a, you know, and it's just that thing that survives of your memory of what kind of a parent you were. And I guess at the end of the day, it's a great equalizer that our children will, in the end, control the narrative of what kind of parents we were, no matter what we want to tell ourselves about how we were as parents.
Yeah, I wonder about that dynamic too, because what you're really talking about there is the way our conception of how our behavior will be received shapes how we actually form that behavior. And that goes into, I guess, these ideas around leadership and guidance that figure into ideas of parenting. And as we've commented a couple of times, always kind of lurking in the atmosphere of Life After Truth is this figure of Fred Reese, but also his father, who is president. And there's a point where Eloise ponders to herself about the need for more benevolently charismatic world leaders. And it's sort of in that statement, it kind of felt like that word benevolent, the idea that we need the outward facing behavior to be something that we can enjoy, but we need it to then actually kind of mirror our own morality in that benevolence. And I wondered, you know, whether this whole idea of charisma and personality in leaders was maybe failed or lacking to begin with. You know, do we need the good parent, or do we just need the parent who'll do what needs to be done?
I don't know. That's a good question. I guess the danger of that formation of paternalistic, whether it's benevolent or malevolent, notion of a leader is that, you know, it's lack of the draw, which one you get. And so the charisma can go in either way. But, I think it's the sense that, you know, the response, the antidote perhaps to that negative, dark energy that someone like a Trump, you know, seems to draw and then generate, you know, that's very fascinating to me. Like, what is it that people are being drawn to there? And it's that, you know, we can't deny that that has a power and an attraction for a huge number of Americans, and possibly, you know, people around the world. And so perhaps in these times, the best antidote to that is this: keep the charisma and the magic and that, you know, power of attraction, but try and pick the leader who's benevolent, like, you know, Jacinda in New Zealand, or the way that Obama would had that same magnetic force, but it was this force for good. And perhaps that's the best, really, that we can do.
And I guess as in a parent, so in a leader, we don't want to just see someone whose entire performance and self-conception turns on the idea that they will be liked. I mean, there's the great scene again towards the end where I think it's Mariam is talking about how at train stations, these liminal zones, diet, food, it's no holds barred. They're allowed to indulge. They've already gone through a box of donuts and had a big serve of fries. But that is the indulgence. You can't, as a parent or as a leader, just simply be, I'm going to do what will make you like me the most, because donuts all day, every day, just is no good for a growing population.
Yes, that's so true. And it's such a, actually, probably if I had to pick one thing that I've learned that's been most useful from parenting that I can then take with me into other aspects of my life, it's letting go of likability. And I think it's a particularly female, you know, problem, because we tend to be socialized to put likability above all else. And it doesn't mean that being likable doesn't help you get things done in the world. So it can be a very useful, you know, survival skill and a smart strategy for, you know, building alliances and actually doing good in the world. But there comes a time where you also have to realize that, you know, you cannot be doing things because you want to be likable. And that's what parenting taught me. Like, you know, it's such a weird shift from when you have a baby to when you have a toddler. When you have a baby, all you have to do to be a great mother is give them exactly what they want when they want it. That's being a great mother. And no one really warned you that actually then what's so hard about having a toddler is that to be a good parent, you basically have to frustrate their needs 99% of the time. And you cannot care if they like you for it. You know, it's actually your job is to say no to their tyrannical demands. And it was a transition I really, you know, struggled with, because I just couldn't, it was such a massive change in the mandate of what being a good mother was. I thought I had it down pat, you know, with the baby, and then suddenly I was like, and I guess that's useful for anybody to take into life. And now I just care less about whether I'm likable to people in other spheres of my life, and that feels actually like a relief.
Keridan, I could speculate endlessly and discuss all the depths of life after truth. You have been tremendously generous with your time chatting today. I am speaking with Keridan Dovey. Her new novel is Life After Truth. It is terrific. We kind of got lost at the beginning there. We talked about how there is kind of a bit of a murder mystery there. And I mean, gosh, lovers of anything can get something out of Life After Truth. Thank you so much for chatting to me today.
Thank you, Andrew.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
This is Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. My name is Andrew Popel, and look, I like to think we put the stories in the stories, ideas, and music. Today on the show, I have been discussing the new novel, Life After Truth, from Keridan Dovey. Thank you so much to Keridan for joining me on the show. Now, this has been one of those absolutely fantastic interviews where Keridan and I, when we spoke, we had such a long and varied chat. So I would encourage you, check us out on the podcast. Now, Keridan and I spoke much more about genre and the way she uses and subverts genre. There's a whole lot more stuff around the robotics and transhumanist theories that are incorporated into parts of her book. So if you want to discover more of that, it's going to be up on the podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, look for Final Draft Great Conversations. My name is Andrew Popel. I am, I'm going to have to leave you soon, but did you know Final Draft goes to air every Saturday morning and every Wednesday evening? So you have two chances during the week to tune in. You can also listen back on 2ser.com. Thank you everyone who loves books. Thank you everyone who discovers books through the show. If you want to get in touch, drop us a line on any of the socials. We are there. Go to @FinalDraft2SER. I've got to say goodbye. I will be back next week. I think I've got a new one from Sophia Laguna, Miles Franklin winner Sophia Laguna. I'm Andrew Popel. This is Final Draft. Till next week, happy reading. Bye.